This is the Voice of America, broadcasting throughout the world with live coverage of the flight of Apollo 14. Now, 113 hours, 37 minutes into the mission, with the lunar module Antares resting on the Frimaro Highlands of the Moon. Astronauts Alan Shepard and Edgar Mitchell are preparing for the first of two scheduled moonwalks. Now to the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston for Rhett Turner's description of the first EVA.
We're listening to Mission Control in Houston as the voices of Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell are heard as they're preparing for the EVA. They're running just a little bit late. It took them a little longer to have their meal and then get the backpacks mounted. Also, the capsule communicator talking with them from the Mission Control room. So far, they have not climbed out. And with us this morning to assist in describing the activities for you is a man whose expertise is just as good as it can be, the second man to set foot on the moon, Colonel Edwin Buzz Aldrin, who landed with Neil Armstrong on Tranquility Base in July of 1969. Buzz, thank you very, very much for coming over and helping tell our worldwide audience about this third landing on the moon and the activities.
Well, thank you very much, Rhett. It looks to me like it's going to be a very, very exciting day. Many improvements have been made since our flight, and of course we'll be looking at a much longer EVA period or an excursion on the moon, which should last 4.5, perhaps 5 hours instead of the 2.5 hours that we had.
You helped set the pace for this broader and broader exploration, and you helped test the equipment with that very first landing, which now is expanding, right?
Well, the primary mission that we had, of course, was to demonstrate that the equipment that we were carrying would work and that men could operate freely on the surface. And as further missions go to the surface of the moon, we'll be extending our capabilities and adding to the amount of scientific return that we were able to bring back.
And hopefully this Apollo 14 mission is going to greatly expand our scientific knowledge about the moon. Let's tune in to the air-to-ground conversation now and see what's happening there as Al Shepard is getting ready to depressurize the cabin.
Al, this is Houston. Long count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Adjust the wheel for Houston. 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Over.
Okay.
Having just a little trouble there with the radio checks, getting the radios checked out.
Yes, I just heard a little recently that they had switched the configuration to see if they could straighten out some of the communication difficulties. If you remember, we had a little bit of difficulty while we were in the cabin communicating back with Houston.
One of the biggest problems is the antenna on your backpack touching the roof of the cabin. As that flexible antenna scrapes around on the cabin roof of the limb, you can hear a scratching sound. I've noticed that in most of the missions so far.
Yes, as long as the antenna is inside the spacecraft, it doesn't have the same transmission capability because the antenna that would normally receive that is on the outside in the rear portion of the lunar module.
Mm-hmm. Let's see.
I understand you've gone to the extreme position on the volume controls. I understand Al's gone to the extreme position on the volume controls. I'll give you a long count here, and why don't you have him cycle or run the wheel from one end to the other and see if at any point along the line he receives anything. Over.
What's the wheel he's turning when he talks about the wheel?
This is a sensitivity or volume control. It's much like radios that you have. You just turn up the volume.
Is it on the chest?
No, it's on the control box that's mounted on the front of the suit. And
mm-hmm.
This control is then relayed back to the set itself, which is on the backpack,
mm-hmm.
through a cable that runs around the side mm-hmm. of the astronaut.
Quiet now while he's adjusting it, probably.
Rather. This particular wheel that we're talking about is on the bottom, and you can't see it from the top, so you have to know which is the high and the low position to experience.
And he's sure feeling this through his glove in the pressure suit,
right? Right.
Yes, this is Houston.
Call from Bruce McCandless.
Ed, we'd like you to set up with yourself in mode Alpha, Al in mode Bravo, and attempt a comm check between the two of you and you with us. Over.
An instruction
okay.
from the sandwich.
Which one?
We want Al in mode Bravo and yourself in mode Alpha.
Okay. Al in Bravo, me in Alpha, and we will try our comm check again.
Roger.
There's an instruction from Bruce McCandless to Ed Mitchell. And you could hear that exchange.
Houston, for that check, observe. You still want VHF-A, VHF-B arm on the LMP panel.
That's affirmative, and on the commander's panel, it's ATR and B received. We have reversed the relay routing through the CDR and LMP audio panels.
I understand that. Okay, you're at ATR and B received, right? Right. Okay, let's you go Bravo, I go Alpha.
Buzz, while they're trying to get this communications check, let's talk about another one of the improvements that has been accomplished for Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell. And this is one of those emergency systems that could save a man's life should something go wrong, right?
Yes, this is a buddy system whereby if the normal oxygen supply in the backpack on either of the astronauts fails or has a leak in it for some reason, why, the other astronaut could hook his oxygen supply into the one that is having the problem, and together, in a buddy system, they could share the oxygen that's available in the remaining suit.
Uh-huh. This is just a long tube that carries both water and oxygen, and I presume communications, if necessary, or at least water and oxygen back and forth.
Yes, I don't think it hooks the communications together.
Mm-hmm. How long? About how long is that? Oh,
as a matter of fact, to my knowledge, it just hooks the oxygen systems together. Mm-hmm. The water you'd still have to retain connected directly to the backpack that you're wearing.
I see.
The crew aboard Antares is essentially in a hold, and the crew checklist experienced difficulties with the portable life support systems communications. We'll stand by and continue to monitor. This is Apollo Control, Houston.
That mission commentator for our first excursion to the moon is John McLeish in Mission Control, and we're hearing astronaut Bruce McCandless as the capsule communicator, Alan Shepard and Ed Mitchell in Antares on the surface of the moon. Were you going to make a comment about the comm modes there a moment ago?
Yes, without trying to confuse the audience, why it is a fairly complicated system. Instead of directly communicating back and forth on the same frequency, why, each backpack is a little bit different from the other one. In other words, there's a one set and another set, and the two are not completely interchangeable.
Mm-hmm.
So when Al Shepard transmits to Ed Mitchell, why, he's transmitting on one frequency, and then Ed Mitchell, if we're in, say, an alpha mode, well, Ed Mitchell will pick up that transmission that Shepard sends to him and retransmit it back to the lunar module along with his own transmission that he then transmits to Shepard on a different frequency.
Or as was indicated, Bravo, A and
right.
B, Alpha and Bravo.
Now, in addition to these transmitting frequencies, where there is the data on the condition of the backpack, its pressures, temperatures, and the various other sensors that are available. Now, these are sent on a different frequency, and these are also relayed back to the lunar module, and there they're picked up, and the transmissions between the astronauts and to the lunar module are on VHF, or very high frequency,
mm-hmm.
and of course, the communications that are sent back to the Earth
from
the lunar module is on S-band frequencies.
This is complex.
Well, yes, and there are several modes of operating it, and one is to put one on an alpha mode and another a Bravo mode, and if that doesn't work, well, then you can switch the two around,
mm-hmm.
and there is a third mode, but as soon as you go into a third mode of communication, well, you begin to lose the capability to to transmit some of the data from the backpacks. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we'd like not to have to do that.
What kind of data, medical data, is transmitted from the backpacks?
Well, as I remember, it is the respiration, the heart rate.
You do get those,
That's
too.
Right. We do get those. There are measures of oxygen pressure and temperatures, inlet temperatures, outlet temperatures, water pressure, battery conditions. There are about 15 to 20 different parameters that are measured.
Then that means that the doctor in Mission Control on his console is watching the astronaut biomedical information. And is there another console for the PLIS?
Yes,
the Hamilton Standard people?
Right. Those those technicians are watching those parameters very closely.
Mm-hmm. That's to you. So you get an idea of how much support there is right here on Earth if all the communications is working properly, on how much backup there is on watching the condition of every part of the system when the astronaut is out on the surface. Let's see. Here, Al says he thinks a circuit breaker was off.
Houston, Ed.
This is Ed.
Loud and clear, Ed.
Your audio circuit breaker is
in. Yes, yes.
We're talking about a circuit breaker.
This is Houston, loud and clear.
It seems to me we're hearing them better now.
Yeah. Whoops. Well, something just went down for a moment. Well, there it ended.
I see.
Ed, this is Houston. Over.
Houston, this is Ed. How do you read?
Ed,
this is Ed. How do you read?
Ed, this is Houston. Loud and clear.
This is Al. How do you read?
Al, this is Houston.
Let's try one more.
Al, this is Houston. If you're in mode B, you shouldn't be able to read me, but I'm reading you loud and clear.
Let's go to AR now. Let's go to AR. Reconfigure the PIM.
All right, we're hearing them.
Okay. Let's put your relay on. Leave it right where it is. We're fine. Don't touch a thing. Okay. Houston, this is Ed. How do you read?
Ed, this is Houston. Loud and clear. How me? Over.
Checking. Roger, loud and clear. Try Al.
There
this
we
is
go.
Al, how do you read, Houston?
Al, this is Houston. Loud and clear. How me? Over.
That delay for the transmission.
Loud and clear.
Hey, beautiful.
They've got it made.
Okay, I think we got our problem solved.
Sounds like a
circuit
breaker.
Okay, the word from down here is don't touch a thing.
Yeah, we're in good shape.
Sounds
we're
like pure science,
dude.
Pure science, yeah.
Okay.
They're kind of close quarters in there with it getting those backpacks on, too, aren't they, Bud?
Oh, you better believe that. There's not much room to move around inside.
Each man has to sort of help the other get it mounted and tuned up, doesn't he?
Well, you have to do it one after the other. You can't have two people moving around at the same time with those backpacks on. Matter of fact, one of them generally has to turn sideways whenever the other person is turning around or moving inside.
Mm-hmm. Let's see what happens here.
Okay, I'll read out for you.
Read
out. 16, Captain Refresh, verified closed. Circuit breaker.
Okay, he's going through his checklist now, picking
verified
up that timeline, I hope.
Okay.
This is always very frustrating to the people on the ground.
His checklist?
Yeah, for how long it takes a person after landing to get ready. But I assure you, it's a long and laborious process, unstowing all the equipment and getting it configured properly and then putting it on and then going through this checkout, just like what we've seen, to assure that the various frequencies are working.
And these checklists are absolutely necessary. Every pilot in the world knows the importance of a checklist. You don't trust to memory on even in an airplane that you could get back to the ground. But in space and in these spacesuits, the checklist is so long. You must go through this multitude of things, right?
It's a very thick book that you carry. As a matter of fact, there's a book for each different phase of the mission. And further, of course, the astronauts have checklist that they have right with them when they're moving around on the surface. It's a card type strap-on checklist that mounts right onto the wrist of their gloves.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to
flip
thumb through the pages.
Let's see what they're doing here now.
The O2 actuator, if you'll bend over a little bit. Kenneth still up?
Yeah, it's spun back up, Ken. I'll put it down for you.
Okay.
You get to me? Oh, well, there we go. Oh, snapped up nice and clean on the top. Okay, O2. Actuators unstowed.
What kind of an activator is he talking about, Buzz? Do you have any idea on that? He says that.
No, I don't know what that is. You have to realize it's been a year and a half since I've been intimately familiar with this.
With the comm difficulty cleared up.
Yes?
Cleared up. Anterior is about 50 minutes behind in the timeline.
They've dropped a bit more behind in the timeline.
Okay, your line hoses are off. And let them hang down there.
Good.
Okay.
He's reading through his checklist, Al Shepard there.
Master alarm, we'll get up to the ECS system.
Right.
Okay, that's the O2 H2O. Top plate.
That's Ed Mitchell. All right, the astronauts are, as we've been following here, going through their pre-depressurization checklist to make sure that the spacesuits are mounted properly and everything is good and tight. They still have some more checking to do. And in the meantime, this is Rhett Turner with Buzz Aldrin in Houston, and we'll be reporting more to you shortly.
You're listening to the Voice of America's live coverage of the flight of Apollo 14. We'll return to Houston in just a moment, but now, a summary of late world news.
American and South Vietnamese troops continue to arrive at new base camps in Quang Tri Province along the South Vietnam border facing southern Laos. Armored personnel carriers are standing guard as 29,000 Allied troops position themselves across communist supply lines leading from Hanoi deep into South Vietnam. VOA correspondent Roger Cowell reports from Saigon that no major enemy opposition has been encountered since the huge joint operation began last weekend. In neighboring Cambodia, South Vietnamese units operating east of Kampong Cham report killing 69 communist troops in the first major clash in that area since the joint Cambodian-South Vietnamese campaign began Wednesday. Troops from the American 82nd Airborne Division will be airlifted halfway around the world next month to test their ability to move into potential trouble spots quickly. The Defense Department says 1,000 paratroops will be flown to South Korea to take part in joint operations beginning March 3rd. Indian police used tear gas to stop thousands of students from attacking the Pakistan High Commission in New Delhi for the third day. The students were protesting that two members of the Kashmir Liberation Front destroyed the Indian airliner they hijacked to Lahore, West Pakistan, last Saturday. India holds Pakistan responsible for failing to stop the two hijackers from blowing up the plane. India also is banning all Pakistani planes, civilian and military, from flying over India until Pakistan pays for the destroyed plane, its cargo, and mail. The guns along the Suez Canal remained silent after Egypt agreed to extend the Mideast ceasefire until March 7th. Egypt's president, Anwar Sadat, announced the 30-day extension only hours before today's scheduled ceasefire expiration. He also called on Israel to withdraw some of its forces from the occupied east bank of the canal. The president told the National Assembly that if Israel will agree to a partial withdrawal, Egypt will try to open the canal to international shipping. But he said if Israel refuses, then Egypt will have no choice but to use every military means at its disposal. Meanwhile, Israeli Premier Golda Meir criticized President Sadat's ceasefire extension for only 30 days and said no ultimatum will frighten Israel into accepting conditions that might endanger its security. Britain today recognized the new government in Uganda of Major General Idi Amin. The British High Commissioner in Uganda attended the swearing-in ceremony of General Amin. He said he has been instructed to conduct the British government's business with the new government. Thousands attended the ceremonies, which included the swearing-in of General Idi Amin's 18-man cabinet. The general, who led the military coup which ousted President Milton Obote last week, declared a public holiday. The new Ugandan leader promised to keep the country within the Organization of African Unity and the East African Community. At least 27 people were arrested during new outbreaks of violence in Roman Catholic sections of Belfast, Northern Ireland. Demonstrators attacked British army troops with gasoline bombs and stones. There were no reports of serious injuries. Several hundred British troop reinforcements arrived in Belfast, and more are on the way. The troops were sent after six British soldiers were injured in violent riots Wednesday night. At least eight persons died in a major winter storm sweeping across the United States. The storm is spawning tornadoes in the south and blanketing Midwest and northern states with snow and freezing rains. Seven members of one family, including a four-day-old infant, died when a tornado demolished their house trailer at Granada, Mississippi. United Press International quotes Chilean President Salvador Allende as saying he would welcome a visit to Santiago by Cuban Premier Fidel Castro. The news agency says President Allende pointed out that he had not invited the Cuban leader, but added that such a visit would please him very much. The Chilean socialist president, said Premier Castro, will not visit Santiago before April to avoid what he called malicious interpretation of such a trip. This is an apparent reference to Chile's municipal elections in early April. United States skaters lead three of four events after the opening day of the North America Figure Skating Championships at Peterborough, Canada. Harvard student John Misha Petkovic scored so many points in the men's compulsory school figures that he is almost assured of the title. Judy Schwomeyer and Jim Sladke have a big lead after the mandatory figures of the ice dance, and Jojo Starbuck and Ken Shelley of California are in front in Paris competition. That's the news. Bob White reporting.
And you're listening to the Voice of America's worldwide coverage of the flight of Apollo 14, now 114 hours and 2 minutes into the mission. Now back to the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston and correspondent Rhett Turner.
Well, the astronauts of Apollo 14 are running a bit behind schedule in donning their spacesuits and getting out onto the surface. They had some difficulty in establishing their communications modes. As Buzz Aldrin pointed out with us here a moment ago, it takes quite a bit of time for each man to get that big backpack on. In fact, one has to turn sideways and get out of the way. Also took them a little longer after the on-time landing to finish their meal. That's the last meal they'll have for quite a while. The spacecraft touched down on the moon at 9:18 GMT, right on time. Al Shepard fired the descent propulsion system engine for 12 minutes and 46 seconds to bring the spacecraft down right on the target point between what's called the triplet and doublet craters in the Fraumaro section of the moon. He saw them just as soon as he pitched the spacecraft forward, and then he found that the terrain was much rougher than had been anticipated, and so he spent a little extra time hovering and maneuvering the spacecraft to a good touchdown point, which he says was the only smooth point for a touchdown anywhere in the area, in a small depression with the Doublet crater out in front of him to the west, stretching some 10 to 15 meters higher in altitude. They can see a ridge on the distance to the west beyond that. Then they began this extravehicular time period, the preparations for it, shortly after that, after making sure that the lunar module was in good shape and it would not be necessary to take off again or abort for orbiting with the command craft going overhead in orbit. There was a considerable flurry of activity in the Mission Control Center before the lunar module was given the go-ahead for descent and touchdown, and that was because a switch in the spacecraft, which has to do with the abort system, apparently suffered some sort of contamination and shorted out in such a way that it would have told the automatic pilot, the primary guidance and navigation system, the PINGS, to abort, to send the spacecraft back up into orbit while it was in its automatic pilot mode of attempting to land. So, between all of the hundreds of people in the staff support room in Mission Control and the instrumentation laboratory of MIT at Cambridge, Massachusetts, and everyone concerned with the computer program and the guidance and navigation system, they came up, and also the simulators at Cape Kennedy and here in Houston, the engineers on the ground came up with a method of operation that would enable Al Shepard to continue using the primary guidance system for touchdown and to just override or bypass this one little anomaly in the computer program. At a certain time during the descent, the computer program would come across this switch in the wrong position. The switch would say abort, and so the automatic guidance, the autopilot, if you will, would then attempt to take the spacecraft back up instead of letting it go on down. So, with all the brains at work, they came up with a mode that certainly worked perfectly. Al Shepard was able to use the primary guidance system for bringing the spacecraft right on down to a real pinpoint landing within about 10 meters of the touchdown point, of the target point originally planned in the pre-mission planning. This spot is just about 140 or 50 meters south of the touchdown point originally planned for the Apollo 13 mission, which didn't make it back in April of last year. But it's the same landing spot, and the astronauts who were, one of the astronauts particularly, who was to have landed on that site, astronaut Fred Hayes of Apollo 13, is one of our capsule communicators here on this mission, and you'll hear a lot of good-natured kidding between Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell and Fred Hayes as to the fact that Shepard and Mitchell made it, but Fred didn't. Let's listen to the astronauts. Here they are as they're still working on their pressure suits, which has caused some delay. Each is helping the other make sure that the PLSS, the Portable Life Support System, PLSS, make sure it is working properly. All of this has to be checked out with a meticulous checklist, as Buzz Aldrin pointed out, before the cabin is depressurized. The astronauts, remember, are living within that small atmosphere.
Do you want to hose verb?
Yep, they're all connected.
Okay, let me read while you verify. Helmet advisor, aligned and adjusted.
Okay.
Bus outside now. Adjusted. Three oxygen connectors locked.
Okay.
Three oxygen connectors locked. Okay, one purge valve locked.
Purge valve locked.
Check the water connector.
Locked.
Gain the comm connector.
It's locked.
Okay, read for me.
Okay. Helmet advisor.
Gain the lever.
And push the tag down.
See all your flags.
Yep. Okay,
that's not.
Dimitra, I'm on and locked.
Water connector.
Water connector is on and locked.
Probe connector.
Probe connector is on and locked.
Okay.
Hey, verify EVA circuit breaker configuration.
Al Shepard verifying to Ed Mitchell his checklist. I heard a great sigh of relief there as something was just concluded.
See, they should be putting on helmets and gloves now and then going into a pressure integrity check of their suits. And then shortly after that, I think we'll get around to the cabin depressurization.
If you just tuned in with us, you're listening to the Voice of America's worldwide coverage of the first exploration of the moon by the astronauts of Apollo 14, Alan Shepard and Ed Mitchell. This is Rhett Turner in Houston, and with me to help describe it is astronaut Edwin Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon, from Apollo 11. In 1969. Buzz, while they're preparing, tell us a little bit about your activities since that historic landing.
Well, it's only been a year and a half, but it almost seems like it's been 5 or 10 years ago since...
Really?
We flew to the moon. Many things have happened, of course. Shortly after we came back, we went on a very interesting trip around the world to many of the capitals of the countries. We visited about 25 countries, and in all it took us 45 days. I think we visited some 30 to 35 cities.
Do you have any idea how many people you actually saw in those tremendous parades? That I remember some historic proportions there. It was just millions and millions of people everywhere.
Well, of course, we didn't really have a chance to stop and count.
No, of course you didn't. Have you heard any reports from anyone on that since
no,
then?
No, I don't think anyone was really... making an accurate measurement.
And time has passed fast, although it makes it seem a long time ago since you were there. You ready to go back again?
Well, I would certainly like to. The training time is long and involved for such a trip like that. And I think the three of us felt that perhaps we could best devote our experiences to other endeavors and perhaps to make room for some of the other people who haven't had the chance to get to the moon.
Neil Armstrong, who preceded you in stepping out onto the lunar surface, is now director of aeronautical research programs for the space agency. Michael Collins, Mike, has joined the State Department as a public affairs officer, and now, as I understand it, you're planning to return to the Air Force to command a test pilot organization. Is that right?
Yes. In July of this year, I'll return back to service with the Air Force as commandant of the Aerospace Research Pilot School at Edwards Air Force Base.
That's where so many of you hot pilots came to the astronaut program from, as I understand.
That's right. Quite a few of the astronauts have gone through training there at Edwards.
So all three of you who landed, went to the moon first there for that first lunar landing, then will have moved into new jobs by July. Huh?
Well, of course, I've been in sort of a new job. For the past year, I've been working with some of our advanced programs, in particular the space shuttle, a two-stage reusable rocket vehicle that would be capable of flying perhaps in 1976 or 77 and could carry up to 12 passengers into orbit around the Earth in perhaps polar orbit or easterly orbits. And could, in addition, carry up to 25 or 35,000 pounds of cargo.
Now, Buzz, you are a colonel in the Air Force, full colonel now, and as I understand it, I'll say this, I expect we'll be seeing General Aldrin here in the next few months, and my hearty good wishes to you on pursuing that program with the test pilot school.
Well, I wouldn't be quite as optimistic. It may be more than a few months. Promotion boards meet on yearly cycles, and course, I have high hopes, but...
I wanted our listeners to know that I'm sure it's in the works and that Buzz Aldrin is going on to good things here. Well, I heard an okay there. Let's check in on what's happening. This is Ed Mitchell and Al Shepard.
He's getting egress.
He's getting his coolant.
Ready for puss O2 on? Puss O2 on.
Plus O2 on. That's a clearly definable spot in the flight plan, isn't it, Buzz? That's a point at which we can make a check on how they're progressing in the timeline, isn't it?
Yes, their checklist, of course, is much more detailed than the one that we have in front of us.
Pressure integrity check.
That's flight clear, 3.2.
3.2 pounds pressure?
That's 3.2 pounds per square inch. That's the pressure that's inside the suit.
Is that what you use outside?
Well, it should go up to about 3.7 or 3.8.
Mm-hmm.
But just flight clear, 3.7.
There it is. You said it.
Are you ready for the 1 minute check? Am I reading you? Okay, try it. Okay, you hear me now? Yeah, okay. I was reading you. Yeah.
Don't touch that comm system.
Okay, you ready to bring Puss O2 up? Okay, where are we? We'll do it at 20.
Now, they've got the normal pressure inside the lunar module at this point, which is about 5 pounds per square inch. And they have elevated the pressure inside their suit to be above the cabin pressure. And what they're going to do is to check the ability of the suits to retain this oxygen pressure without leaking. In order to do that, they're going to turn off the oxygen supply that's coming from the backpack and to see how much the pressure drops in 30 seconds or 1 minute.
That's the integrity check?
That's the pressure integrity check.
There's always just a slight loss, even in a seemingly perfectly sealed container, isn't there?
Yes, it's virtually impossible to design a system to retain the oxygen pressure without any leak at all.
I recall in checking out...
Okay, yes, then we're 1 minute.
There you go.
Both suits are tight. Plus O2 is going back on.
That's Shepard.
And we're standing by for cabin deep breath.
Roger, stand by, Antares.
They are indeed about 50 minutes behind.
Yeah, looks like it's just about 50 minutes.
Antares, this is Houston. You are a go for cabin deep breath. Be sure and give us a mark when you start your watch. At the second deep breath.
Okay. Okay, circuit breaker, cabin re-breath open.
It's open now.
Bruce McCandless called for a mark when Al Shepard begins depressurizing the cabin. He depresses it to exactly the suit pressure, doesn't he? The cabin interior.
And let's take.
Well, he will, and then the suit, of course, will build back up again.
Mm-hmm.
It'll drop down the same time that the cabin does. And they'll stop the cabin depress at a point where it's down to a safe level for the suit.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll hold there for just a minute, and then they'll depress the cabin all the way down.
Mm-hmm. And expose it to the lunar vacuum.
Right.
Okay. Drop her on down.
Ready?
Get the latch out of the way.
There we go. There
The depressurization has begun, it sounds like.
2-4.
Now, the reason that the ground wanted to know exactly when they start the clock is so that since the astronauts will be starting stopwatches that they're carrying with them, everyone wants to be on the same time base and know exactly when time zero is, so they want to mark on the ground when they determine on the moon when they're going to start their watches.
And they're beginning to time the use of that portable life support system and its consumables, aren't they?
That's right.
4-8. Coming on down,
says Ed Mitchell. Oh.
Roger, give us a mark.
Getting ready to start the watches, as Buzz said.
Okay, 3, 2, 1, mark it. We're off and running. Time zero.
Okay. Overhead. Okay, forward dump valve open now.
Okay, okay.
That was exactly 50 minutes.
Was it?
Behind the schedule.
I'll be darned.
According to my watch.
I started a clock with him there. We'll keep an eye on it throughout the progress of this. We expect to see color television, too. When Al Shepard steps out, he will open up the modular equipment storage assembly. Is Ed reading those marks off of Al's FLIS unit and vice versa when they talk about a water flag?
No, he's looking at the warning flags. Warning flags that are on his own
indicator unit?
Indicator unit that's on the chest.
Mm-hmm. This is essentially the same suit you wore on the surface, isn't it? Except for the buddy system.
Yes, it is essentially the same.
Mm-hmm.
Still tighter. Better drop. Rest for the better drop.
As time progresses, they do make what, some sort of minor improvements from mission to mission?
Yes, we'll be making a fairly major improvement in the suits on the next flight in an attempt to give greater mobility, especially in tilting the head forward and also bending at the waist so that you could reach down and pick objects up off the surface without difficulty.
You know, this is something I think that many listeners maybe not be aware of, and that is that when this suit is pumped up tight and you're inside it, you can't bend too much, can you? That's why you hop around just a bit there. You want to talk about that a minute?
Yes, there are joints and rings and bladders and convolutes that do move in an attempt to give you the same mobility that you have moving around without a suit on.
But you're surrounded by a pressure bladder,
right.
A rubber
bladder. Just like you have a balloon, and you're inside this balloon. And, of course, on the outer covering of this balloon are many, many layers of thermal protective coatings. And then, of course, there's the outer covering of white material.
To what extent can you lean over in the present suit or turn your arms or your head?
Well, it's been a tremendous improvement since the beginning of spacesuits.
In the Apollo suit, the one you wore in this
right.
one.
Right. And we found that we could adequately move around, but there was the restraint and constraint which tended to not let you take complete advantage of the ease of movement that's afforded by the decreased lunar gravity.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, it almost puts you back to the same capability that you have to move around on the surface of the Earth, but the decreased gravity has the effect of delaying your coming back down, so that if you're running or jogging, why, it takes longer from step to step, and the net effect is as if you're moving in slow motion.
Mm-hmm. This is astronaut Buzz Aldrin with us, reporting for you the first exploration of the lunar surface of Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell of Apollo 14, the Voice of America's worldwide coverage of the Apollo 14 mission to the moon. This is Rhett Turner in Houston. We're standing by, waiting for more communication here now from the astronauts on the surface. The cabin has been depressurized, and there's still some final preparation procedure before first Alan Shepard will go through the hatch and step out onto the surface, becoming the fifth man on the moon. I had to stop and count there a moment. Buzz, you were the second. Neil Armstrong was first. Then Pete Conrad was third. Alan Bean was fourth. Then Al Shepard will be the fifth. One comment there.
Don't have the amps and ECS caution lights.
Oh, they're off.
Are they? Oh, I see. You're going to undim. Okay. Let's try to see them over there.
Comments okay. And Shepard.
Getting a water flight clear here in a minute.
What they're waiting for now is the water flag.
Okay, my PGA is getting down to about
the cooling for the suit is 4-3 obtained
now.
By evaporating water
okay,
as it goes from a liquid
two.
State to a gaseous state. And it does this by first freezing and building up a coating in the sublimator in the back pipe. And then through this cake of ice, the water continues to move through it. And this provides the cooling. Now, it takes a while for this to operate, and it can't build up.
Until you're in vacuum.
Except when you're in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to be very careful that you don't have this break off while you're in the process of doing it. Have some of this ice cake break off.
Inside the spacecraft.
Yeah, this is Houston. We're showing your feed water pressure going up. You ought to be in business shortly.
This sublimator was an interesting invention,
pressure,
too.
Water flag just cleared.
Well, it's not an invention. It's a discovery of how to use the elements.
I hope that we may find some spin-off, some new uses for this in our technology on Earth. There's that possibility.
Well, I think we'll see many uses of the equipment and the procedures and techniques that have been developed for space, and they'll be continuing to come as years go by.
If we started on that subject, we could go for the rest of our broadcast time, I think.
I'm sure we could.
Okay. Shepard.
Okay. Lighting an MC unit to DIM.
Okay.
DIM, stop the DET.
Okay, DET is stopped.
Okay.
Well, the hatch recently opened.
Ready?
Sounds like they're opening the hatch.
I think they had it open a little bit
before, but...
Okay,
Al has to move out of the way in order to get the hatch completely open. He has to back into the corner of his part of the lunar module.
Let me get it. That's fine. Okay, can you get everything now? Okay.
I think he's making up a little of that time here as he goes.
Well, they've got plenty of time on the lunar surface. There's no need to rush.
Nope.
Oh, wait now. All right, wait. Okay, very good.
I'll get your antenna as you go out.
All righty, starting out the door.
There it is, Al Shepard starting out the door.
The normal position, of course, in the lunar module is facing forward. Now, what he has to do is turn around and face the aft portion of the cabin and then... slowly get down on his knees and then back out feet first out the front hatch.
There you go. Now you're clear. You hit down as soon as you can. Back on out.
Little platform out there called the front porch.
Let me get your antenna. Hold it.
Okay?
I'll have to get mine when I come out.
Okay.
You're clear. One out.
He's in the process of backing out the door then
okay,
to the little platform.
Back.
That's Al Shepard.
Hey, come in again,
Roger, let me get over here on the other side so I can get to it.
It's a squeeze getting through there with that backpack on too, isn't it?
Yes, the tolerances are quite close. There's maybe 2 or 3 inches all the way around. And, of course, when you're in the suit with the helmet on and the visor and everything on top of it, it's very difficult for you to tell exactly where you are or where the rest of you is.
Do you feel like you're practically down on your stomach sliding out
there? Yeah, jettison bag has materials the crew will not use on lunar exploration.
I'm hung up on something else.
Well, there. my question, Buzz, do you feel like you're practically...
It's very close. You're essentially on your elbows or your arms and your knees.
Mm-hmm.
And you just gradually slide yourself backwards. There is a corrugation on the front porch where the metal goes up and down that lets you move out slowly without any danger of slipping.
Mm-hmm. I suppose Al's out there on that porch by now.
We've got it now standing by for the LEC.
He's waiting for the conveyor, the clothesline. Is there a better word than a clothesline? I often wonder what the most universal term would be for the LEC.
Well, clothesline is perhaps the best understood. I'm not sure that clotheslines as we know them are in use in the same way throughout the world.
But anyway, it's a cord that can be pulled, it's a loop that can be handled by each astronaut, one inside and one outside, and then various equipment just brought out on the line.
Yes, there's a wheel or a pulley inside the cabin of the lunar module, and this loop extends on out, and suspended from the lower portion of the loop, you can attach a bag, and you can send the sample containers and also batteries and so forth up and down.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's made all the more stark by the fact that the sky is completely black.
Shepard says it's startling. The sky is completely black in the Farmara section there. The sun is ahead of him behind the lunar module.
Now. Out of the bag.
He mentions one of the bags. The communication's clearer now that he's out, I think.
Well, as he mentioned, as he moved outside the hatch, or as he was passing by Ed Mitchell, Ed reached down and deployed the antenna that's mounted on the back of the backpack.
Does it not stick up and drag the surface as I had suspected?
Yes, if you had that deployed inside the cabin, it would create a good bit of interference by scraping on the ceiling.
It is flexible and rolls up, sort of, doesn't it?
Yes, it'll roll up or fold over and lay flat.
The MESA has been deployed.
The modular equipment storage assembly. This is the thing that has the tools in it and also a television camera.
Okay,
so maybe we'll get some TV.
We can see you coming down the ladder right now. It looks like you're about on the bottom step. And on the surface. That's bad for it, old man. Okay, you're right. Al is on the surface. It's been a long way, but we're here.
Al is on the surface of the moon now.
Yeah, looks like quite a
picture.
The
reason we have a tilt is because we landed on the slope. The landing gear struts appear to be about evenly depressed.
Roger out.
And moving around, getting familiar with the surface. Surface in which the forward pad landed is extremely soft. Matter of fact, it's in a small depression. The soil is so soft that it comes up all the way to the top of the foot pad. And even folded over the side to some degree. The same is true of the plus Y strut.
Roger.
Okay, we'll move on over. Take a look at take a look at Cone Crater, I should say, which is right where it should be, and is a very impressive sight.
And Terry, this is Houston. You are go for two-man EVA. Over.
That's a milestone, I presume. Go for two men.
Thank you. And continuing, we can see the boulders on the rim. It looks as though we have a good traverse route up to the top of Cone. I can see Cone Ridge going along to the north That's very apparent.
If you look closely, the picture is so clear that you can see the reflection of Al moving around on the surface on the shiny material that covers the front leg of the lunar module.
I'm moving over to adjust the mesa.
Roger, Al.
He may come into the view again. He stepped right off rather quickly after getting on that footband, didn't he? He knew what to expect, thanks to you and me, Buzz.
Quite fortunately, our training and simulations were very close, and it didn't take us long to verify that it was very easy to move around on the surface.
Roger, Ed.
Looks like he's moved the camera a little bit. Mm-hmm.
So you know what, to remove the net blanket.
This is the cart. This is the one of the new devices, the MET. We've come to call it the Mobile Equipment Transporter. I think they use the word modular or something, too, in building up the acronym.
I think a better understood term is a rickshaw.
Rickshaw. That is a good one. You can see Al Shepard's top of his helmet. Incidentally, he has some stripes on his suit, a red stripe across his helmet. He has some red armbands on his sleeves and on his legs to identify him, the commander Al Shepard. Mitchell's suit will not show these in the live television transmission. And for the first time, we have a very good clear color picture from the moon. Color television. This is an immense assist. Al's moving the picture, the camera now. And he probably will have it so we can see Ed come down.
I think he's moving the mesa. Yeah, or the equipment assembly. Yeah. He's lifting it up. That's why the picture is tilted over, because he's going to...
tilting the mesa up slightly now to...
He's going to deploy the rickshaw
met,
from underneath.
Which is a pull cart out from under it.
Now we see Ed starting to come down the ladder.
Ed Mitchell's feet on the ladder coming into view in the TV picture. In a shadow.
Great to be coming down. Roger, bottom step.
He says it's great to be coming down. There he is. That's a long, that long off on the surface. Oh, is he?
No, he jumped back up again.
Check, just to check.
Look how easy it is to get back up on the ladder.
I guess we got there with those lightweight units.
That, I presume, is to make sure you can get back to that first step if you need to in a hurry.
Well, I think it's more to check the ease or the relative difficulty that he might experience later on. It's not a question of checking whether he can get back. If we don't have that confidence, we never should have gone.
Okay.
He's releasing it now. Okay, Houston, the vet is finally clear of the mesa. Al, I'm going to come over. How about getting my antenna out before I lose Tom here in a minute?
Okay.
Like over at the corner or something.
He just dropped his baby over here.
Okay.
His antenna is in a stowed position, too.
The mat will be placed on one of the foot pads.
This is the rickshaw, the MET, which you will hear referred to throughout the explorations, excursions to the surface. The rickshaw part.
Hey,
right.
You'll stop here a minute. I'll get you in out.
Could you tell whether it was the Capcom or whether it was Al who said something about it's not a big step for an old man?
I missed that. Did you hear that?
Yeah.
Who said that?
I don't know.
I missed it.
I don't know whether that was a Capcom or maybe somebody in one of the back rooms.
He's been taking quite a bit of kidding on that. Okay, we talked to him about it.
Mesa has been stowed on the plus Y footpath.
Roger, out.
Al says he wants to be the first astronaut 50 on him. Who's 50 on him? He'd be happy to be.
And going back to adjust the mesa.
Well, I think in 3 years our trips to the moon may be over for a while.
We can see
One of the men
is very great under this crushing 160 load, Houston.
Ed Mitchell is bouncing around, testing out his moon legs.
Shepard now adjusting the television.
And as you heard, Shepard is adjusting the TV set on the mounted on the Mesa still.
Looking at Cone Crater, where I was looking a short time ago, it doesn't appear there's going to be any trouble getting the mount up Cone Crater.
There was some concern about being able to take the equipment transport of the Met up to the top of the crater, sort of like climbing a small mountain.
Yes,